Blog Talk Radio.
I'm in. I just got in. It took me about 10 minutes. Good evening, everybody. How y'all doing? Welcome to the Voice of the People.
Thank you.
Dean Geronimo, Mark Lee. We have our guest, Elizabeth Hine. And we have one other person on the line with us. Who we got calling in?
I believe that's Joshua Hamm. I told him to call in as well. Well, we'll get to him after we talk to Elizabeth.
Okay.
No problem. Good, Mark.
Hey, everybody doing all right over there?
Yeah, it's a great
day. Can't complain.
Not doing any good anyway. So I know we've got Elizabeth, and Elizabeth has written a wonderful book that I've been checking out. That definitely everybody should check out. Dean, if you have not checked it out, you need to go pick up your copy of How to Climb the Eiffel Tower.
Wow. Nice title.
She is a cancer survivor. She said she's ready to take on the world. Ain't that right, Elizabeth?
I am. I'm ready to spread the word about friendship and cancer survivor and all the things that go along with that.
How to climb the Eiffel Tower.
So, Elizabeth, just so we can jump right into it, and I'm sure Dean might want to jump in it as well. I think he's got some people that have been in his life that have gone through things as well. But I know that the book has got some part of your life story in it, but from what I read about it, it's not all autobiographical. You added a little bit of creative license into it.
Yes, it's actually based more on several of the people I met while I was going through my own cancer treatment. And I took quite a bit of artistic license with their stories. I really wanted to have a protagonist that had a cancer that was more of a metaphor for her life. She has cervical cancer, which is one of the few cancers that can be caught. It's actually caused by a sexually transmitted bacteria, the HPV. And you can be vaccinated against it now. So she had a difficult childhood. There was a lot of abuse in her childhood, and that was actually growing as cancer in her body. So then throughout the year that takes place within the book, she not only is healed from the cancer, but is also healed from the trauma of her childhood. So at the end, she is a new and improved individual.
Nice.
A quick synopsis of the book.
Very quick synopsis, but a very accurate synopsis.
Yeah.
And how late into your life was it that you were diagnosed with your own cancer? I think it was like, if I remember correctly, it might have been in the 30s or something like that. And
yes,
does it run in the family?
No. I was 34 years old when I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a blood cancer. And actually, I was a little old to get diagnosed with Hodgkin's. Usually, people who get that type of lymphoma are in their late teens or early 20s. But I was 34, and I was the mother of two young children. They were 8 and 5 at the time, and I was very ill. And it took a whole year of treatment. But I came out on the other side, treated, and I've been in remission since 2002. So it worked. The treatment did work.
Wow, so that's been, this is 2015, so 13 years in remission. That's really a great testimony that you've been in remission that long.
The treatment is difficult, but it works very well for that type of cancer. Very effective in time.
And how did your kids, they were very young at the time that you were diagnosed, how did they take on those kind of responsibilities? I imagine that, they're used to mom taking care of them and everything, and then all of a sudden they see her being not her usual, probably peppy and enforcing self.
Right. Well, they were pretty upset about it. But the saving grace was I have wonderful parents and I have wonderful in-laws. And they took turns 3 weeks on and 3 weeks off taking care of me and my husband and my kids. So there was always a grandma here at all times, a grandma and a grandpa. So their little schedules were kept going, and they got to school, and they were fed, clothed, and took to bed every night, which was wonderful for me. I could just concentrate on my healing, my treatment, and not be worried about them. But there's been long-term fears, and they're, of course, worried about it, even though it's not hereditary, but it's still always in their mind.
So they're worried about it possibly coming back and happening in their lives as well as they get older. Because you said a lot of times it happens to kids when it's initially diagnosed.
Yes. And in the intervening 13 years, they've seen their grandmother get cancer and several aunts. So it's been a big part of our family, unfortunately. So
yeah,
rough 2 years.
Because, Dean, I think you've had to deal with cancer as well in your family history, haven't you?
Yeah, I've had a couple of uncles who passed away, one from colon cancer and the other one from prostate cancer. So those are, I watched them, my godfather as well, and I watched them go down to almost nothing, man. And, dealing with the chemo and the chemo weakened the systems to the point where, they eventually passed away. So, and they're...
How much with your kind of cancer, Hodgkin's, how much is it with chemo, or have they found some other kind of alternative cures for Hodgkin's?
No, it is chemo. It's 6 months of chemo and then about 4 months of radiation on top of that.
Wow.
And so when I wanted to write this book, I wanted her to not have to go through that much. I was like, when you're an author, you can do whatever you want to your characters. And so I wanted her to just have to go through radiation. And because you're not so visibly ill, when you go through radiation, your hair doesn't fall out, you don't look as bad, and you're not getting sick. And so she was able to go through treatment and not have to really tell very many people. And she doesn't tell very many people that she is ill. There's maybe 3 or 4 people in the world that know that she's even ill, never mind going through treatment. So that's a large part of the plot, being able to share that with other people and being more forthcoming with her own personal issues.
And I know a lot of times they tell you that when you're dealing with any kind of illness whatsoever, that comedy or just having a sense of humor can help with the cure and help get through it. And it definitely sounds like your character, Laura, definitely did that, because there's definitely some comic relief within the story.
There is quite a bit of comic relief. When I first sat down, the first drafts of this book were a real downer, because it was trying to get the facts down, get the plot down. So then in subsequent drafts, I made a real point. There was quite a bit of comedy. And Lara is very snarky of a character. The way she looks at the world is very comical. And her whole work life is fodder comedy. Her work life is hilarious as far as quirky people, which is fun.
Well, we both have worked at an office that is full of quirky people, so you probably have new fodder now for your book. Now that you've worked in measurement for a while, you probably have new fodder.
Well, it's interesting working with you at Measurement. I started thinking like my character and naming people the way she names people and making up little backstories and ideas about the people you meet on an everyday basis, very much the way she would see it, which is kind of weird to have life imitating
life,
art.
Life imitating art, and some of those people, if they knew what characters you gave to them, might be utterly amazed, or they might go with
probably
it.
Probably not too happy. That's
nothing wrong with that. Now, I know at one point in the book, you also, one of your characters actually was somewhat critical of some of the more, I hate to put it this way, but some of the more glamorous kind of cancers mm-hmm. to get more attention by the media. I think she called them the Pink Ribbon Brigade.
Yes. Yeah, and that is actually comes directly out of some experiences that I had when I was going through treatment. You know, the breast cancer organizations have done a very good job of publicizing breast cancer awareness, but sometimes people assume, I think they've almost done a bit of a job to a certain extent, that when you're a woman, get cancer, people assume you have breast cancer. And they're kind of like, oh, it's not breast cancer? Well, whatever, you know, kind of thing. And I think the gynecological cancers, cervical, ovarian, vaginal, you know, all endometrial, need a little bit more press, I guess you could say, to get people talking about them more, kind of the way breast cancer was doing in the late 70s and early 80s. We need to be doing that in the 2000s to get more awareness towards that, because it is a much larger killer than breast cancer just in our lives as people. And also, one of the characters, Jane, who's the friend of Lara, she has lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And I found when I was going through treatment, when people would find out that a person has lung cancer, the first thing they would say is, oh, well, did you smoke? Well, you know, frankly, even if you did smoke, the person's got lung cancer. It's, you know, a very serious disease that you may very well die from. That's very rude to say, oh, did you smoke?
Yeah, it does seem that some people just automatically make that assumption that if it's lung cancer or if it's some of those other cancers that might have been impacted by cigarettes or other kinds of things, like even some people with alcohol, they may assume that certain cancers come from that, even though I agree that it's kind of rude for them to try to stereotype people based on what their habits may have been that may have led to it or may not have, because some people get lung cancer just by contact and being around people that smoke.
Yes, and even if they did smoke, that doesn't mean that they deserve to get cancer. You know, it's still a terrible disease, and they're in a lot of pain and may very well die. So, you know, too late now. You shouldn't blame people for that. But it's an interesting thing in the pink ribbon. You get, you know, when you're going, you get very tired, a little pink hat. But there's really nothing fun and cute about cancer. It's a terrible disease.
I'm sure there's not at all. How much of the support groups and things of that are you involved with? Even currently, because, I mean, you've been dealing with it and been in remission for close to 13 years now. So are you still very much involved with, like, support groups, or not as much now that it's further in your life?
A little bit less than I was, say, maybe 5 years after I was treated. But I am active on several groups on, like, Facebook. I also still see my oncologist once a year, and I've made it very clear to him that I'm more than willing to talk to anybody who's newly diagnosed and kind of be a buddy people and help through those first few years. You know, because sometimes all you need is to know that somebody else made it through, to walk them through the hospital. And also, whenever I meet anybody that is diagnosed with cancer, I make sure that I help with food, I'll take people to chemo treatments. I mean, I'm not afraid to go and watch people be treated, because I've been there, where a lot of people are very rich. So I try to help the way I can, but it doesn't fit me. Less and less as time goes on.
How much did it change your diet in terms of, like, what you, maybe some of your habits that you had before being diagnosed and what you have now in terms of either diet or just life in general? I mean, did you find yourself becoming more exercise conscious or doing other things that might impact your life as a survivor?
Well, it did affect my diet. Much of the radiation affected my intestines, so I'm unable to eat certain things like gluten, tomatoes, so it did do some damage to my body. But it just took a few years to kind of figure out what I can and cannot eat without having, you know, stomach pain. I'd like to say I'm really fit and active, but I'm not. I'm a lazy individual, so I should exercise more. But it also did help me a lot with doing some more meditation and being more just aware of what my body is doing. And I also, if there's anything wrong, I go see a doctor. I don't want to get in a situation where a small thing becomes a big thing.
Now, were you always that way? Because I know a lot of people in our society, throughout the society, are not the biggest fans of doctors because they're always afraid of what the doctor might find on them. So were you one of those that was always one that went to the doctor, or did you go to the doctor more now because of the treatment and the fact that you were diagnosed and then had and then now in remission? Or were you one of those people that was back in the day would avoid the doctor like the plague?
No, actually, I went to the doctor a lot. I was misdiagnosed for several years before they finally figured out what was wrong with me. But I have learned to be more assertive with doctors, not take, oh, it's okay. I was told by several doctors that before I was finally diagnosed that I should probably lose some weight and get more exercise and not carry my children around quite so much because I complained about back pain and fatigue. And now, if I think there's something wrong, they don't give me a good answer, I go to the doctor because I've learned my lesson.
You're one of those people that will get a second opinion now and not just depend on the doctor's first opinion because you've learned that the doctor may not have given you the right information the first time.
Right. Oh, they weren't taking me seriously. So now it's like, no, you're not taking me seriously. This is really a problem. No, I'll keep going until I get an answer. Either way. So, that's good advice for anybody. If you think there's something wrong with you, find out. Don't take somebody else's word.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
People miss things.
Do you find that a lot of people have that habit of just kind of like automatically listening to the doctor, or maybe the doctor not necessarily wanting to listen to what the patient is trying to tell them?
I think so. Well, I think people are whiny sometimes, and so doctors don't take you very seriously. They're thinking, oh, you're tired. Yeah, get more sleep. You know, they don't really take it seriously when you come in and you say, I'm exhausted all the time. You know, I went to several doctors. I said, you know, I'm exhausted. I can't carry a basket of laundry up by myself kind of thing. And they were like, well, you should work out more and lose some weight. And I was like, no, I have cancer. You know, like, so now if I have a problem and they say, oh, you know, lose some weight or, you know, take an aspirin and call me in the morning, I'm like, yeah, I'm going next, you know, next doctor, because until I get an answer.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, you decided to go kind of the route of the, I mean, you have a small publishing house, I believe it's like Messenger that you're part of, but what made you decide to go that route versus trying to, like, sell it to the big houses like Random House or somebody like that? What made you decide to go as a writer for the more independent kind of way?
Well, I considered all categories. I mean, I talked to several agents who were, frankly, a little weary of a book about somebody who has cancer. They're like, oh, nobody wants to read about that. And then I thought about independently publishing it under my own imprint, because my first book, I did do that, which is a more chick-litty women's fiction book. And then I met this lovely young woman, Elizabeth Turnbull, at a writer's conference, and we connected, and she kind of got the book. She understood who I was, what the book was trying to do, and I really wanted to work with her, and she was a great editor, and she helped me take the book from almost there to fully realized. She helped me make a few changes near the end of the process and helped me kind of bring it to market the way I wanted it to be. And for instance, when I first met her, I didn't have a title. I couldn't come up with a good title. came up with the title, How to Climb the Eiffel Tower. And as soon as she told me that title, I was like, oh, yes, that is the exact title we need. So sometimes you need somebody to help you with that last little bit. You know, whether if you're a musician, you need that producer or that mixer or something like that, or somebody to help with that last song lyric to get you over the hurdle.
I'm sorry. What were you saying, Elizabeth?
I said I really liked working with the small press. They're a small, family-run business, so I felt like I was part of the team as opposed to just, you know, an anonymous person from New York who I never meet, just talk to over email.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you might want to tell the audience exactly how the title came about and what Elizabeth was thinking about when she came up with that title, How to Climb the Eiffel Tower.
Well, the Eiffel Tower plays, you know, looms large in the book. In the first scene where Laura and Jane meet in the waiting room, they have a misunderstanding about climbing the Eiffel Tower. Laura climbs it on her stair stepper every Tuesday afternoon, and Jane misinterprets that and thinks that she's actually climbed the Eiffel Tower. So they have a little conversation about that. And then throughout the book, Jane, who's older, continually tells Laura that she should travel. And there's a very heartwarming scene where Jane tells Laura about the time that she went to the Eiffel Tower and talks to her about her charm bracelet that has an Eiffel Tower charm on it. And I don't want to give it away, but then it's a pivotal scene at the end with that charm. Talks about the Eiffel Tower and promising Jane that she will go at the end of the book. So it kind of comes up several times. And it's a good metaphor for effort and doing something very hard, like getting.
Now, did the blog come after the book, or were you writing the blog before the book? Because you also write a blog that deals a little bit with your literature experiences and just about your writing blog, but also, I imagine, about life in general as well.
Right. No, it did start before it. It's my blog been scribbling in the storage room. Climbing the Eiffel Tower is actually the next book. So I started the blog probably for 3 years, probably 2011, before my first book came out, and go through the process of how do you write a book? How do you find readers? How do you know what you're doing? I love my blog. It's people that I've met through it are very supportive. I'm a member of Insecure Writers Support Group, which is a monthly group that, you know, gives each other support. We kind of cheer for each other when their books come out. Kind of pick each other up when it's having problems. So I like, you know, I'm not a great blogger. I don't blog every day, but at least once a week or maybe twice a week, I talk about what I'm doing, what's going on. And then I also have my website, elizabethhine.com, which is kind of more like where you find my books, press information. And I set up a lot of stuff for book clubs. So if they want to read my power, have suggestions on what they eat, they drink, questions they can discuss, as a resource for them, anything else.
That's great. And what advice would you give to other people that are trying to write books as well?
Well, best advice I have ever gotten is find a buddy. Find a writer's group, a partner that can bounce ideas off of and that can help you see the things that you don't see in your own writing. For instance, I like to read things, and so I sometimes put a little too much information in my books, and I have a good friend who's like, yes, that's all very interesting, but nobody cares. Yeah, like that's this paragraph kind of thing. You know, like right now I'm writing a book about Galapagos Islands, and I had all this about frigate birds, and my friend was like, yeah, no, it's like 2 sentences, that's all we need, you know. Oh, I know so much, you know.
So you hear that, Dee? You can now go write your book, because she's giving you advice, so you can go write your book now, Dee.
You know what? I might need a few more years.
Just keep doing it. Show up every day and just write a little bit. The best way to get there.
Now, Dee, you know you had all those wonderful experiences up there at Virginia State?
Yeah, I will not write about that kind of information.
You know, some things you just take with you, and as you go on and grow up and move on, you keep those with you, and you don't, you know, you never let them out again.
Are you trying to say that there's some things that you're not going to talk about?
Some things I refuse to talk about ever. And we're just going to leave that just like that. It's safer not to speak on those things, you know? Because it can be a little detrimental now. Well.
I said, I'm sure Elizabeth had something.
Yeah, I do. There's plenty of things that I will not write about.
Yeah, some things you just have to let go.
Yep.
Just to be on the safe side. It's safer to just... Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, I noticed one of the things that I really found interesting on one of your pages where you were doing another interview was how you described cancer as a bully. I never thought of it that way. I mean, I guess it makes sense because it does kind of take over your life.
It is a bully. It takes over your body. It takes over your life. It takes over your psyche. And even one of the things that I didn't get to explore in this book but may come up in other books is how it never leaves you alone. Even when you get better, you know, you're through the treatment, you're feeling better, you still think about it all the time and you're worried. For instance, you know, I've been in remission for 13 years, and every time I get a chest cold, I'm like, oh, my God, is it back? You know, so because... Yeah. One of my main symptoms was a terrible cough. And so it's like you go into panic mode every time you have a cough. And I know that, like, for instance, I have some dear friends who've survived ovarian cancer. And every time, you know, they have a little bit of indigestion or any little twinge in their belly, they're like, oh, my gosh, you know, like, what's wrong? And it's just that, you know, they ate their food too fast or something. So... it is a bully. It takes over your life, pushes everything away. Not a nice little disease. And I find it very difficult to get my brain around the fact that cancer is your own cells trying to kill you. That's hard to, you know, get your brain around sometimes.
Right. It's like it's coming from within and trying to attack you out on the outside. Yeah, that is hard to wrap around, and a lot of people have a hard time dealing with that, but that's just one of those ailments that definitely you're sitting there going like, wait a minute, it's my own body eating at me.
Yeah, it is. That's also the way I think. I kind of think very much on from a psychological point of view, and, you know, like the whys of things as opposed to more of the hows. So I think about those things a lot. And when you're sick, you have a tremendous amount of time to lay in bed and think about how much this is bothering you.
And you were also very fortunate, because I know some people that have gone through cancer struggles that were involved in relationships, be it boyfriend, girlfriend, be it husband, wife, be it whatever, and that has put a strain on the relationship. But if anything, from what I've garnered from your reading, from reading on your blog and also talking to you at a measurement a couple of times, it seems to have actually strengthened y'all's bond as a family, which doesn't always happen.
Yes. I was very fortunate. My family, I have an incredibly wonderful family. You know, my mother was right there, and my mother-in-law and my father-in-law, and that's the person actually, you know, you expect your mom to help you, you know, because they're your mom. And my mother-in-law is very much my mom type of person, but it was my father-in-law that really surprised me how he really stepped up. I had, for months, I had a tick line, a line hanging out of my arm where they could put the drugs in, and that needed to be cleaned and taken care of every day. And my mother-in-law just was too squeamish; she couldn't handle it. But my father-in-law was there with the heparin and there with the saline solution, and he was like on top of it. And he took me to almost every chemo treatment, and then he would take me out for breakfast afterwards. And then, you know, he sat there in the waiting room and kept me entertained. I mean, you were there all day, and he just kept me entertained and brought me books and, you know, made me laugh when I was feeling bad. And, you know, not a lot of father-in-laws would do that. He's a really great guy. We became really close in those years that I was sick. And we were close before, and we're still close.
So Go ahead. I'm sorry. So, Dean, it looks like you weren't the only lucky one to find somebody that was your helpmate, because I know you've talked several times about how just in your life, your wife has been there right by your corner and your side. So it seems to me that Elizabeth has found that with her husband.
Yes, that's my tag team partner, man. I mean, you know, going through, I have Crohn's disease, so, you know, untreated forms into colon cancer. But during the times that I've had, like, different things that have happened, you know, my wife has been right there every step of the way. You know, when I first told her, I thought she would say, you know what, okay, well, you know what, that's a little too much for me, I'm out of here. But she said, okay. And at first, I thought, okay, man, you know, let me see how long I can deal with this. But she's actually been very strong, you know, and like I said, right there every step of the way through, you know, the surgery I had, the strokes that I've had, you know, so she's tough, man. She's tough.
That's wonderful that she's been able to help you, because Crohn's is a difficult disease to handle, because it doesn't, you know, there's no cure, right? Just going to have to treat it as you go on, correct?
You know, it has no known cure. It's one of those things where I have to be mindful of what I eat. Some things I can't eat anymore. Like, I used to love beef patties. Can't eat them anymore. So no, I know that, you know, if I come to your house and you're like, yeah, I cook beef patties, I'm like, all right, well, thanks, but there's nothing that I can eat, you know.
Yeah, no, well, that would be not a good plan. Oh,
right.
Oh, wow, that's a tough thing.
Things like hot wings, like most people love hot wings and stuff like that, I can't eat them, you know. So I have to kind of like find something else to eat, and which is fine by me, because after a while of not having something, you really don't miss it a lot. But
that's true.
I still remember when I used to eat them.
Yes, I miss bread. I can't
you
eat
miss
bread.
Bread. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't eat anything with wheat in it. I miss pasta. I miss bread. I miss donuts. But it's not going to happen anymore.
You're the one driving by Krispy Kreme going like, dang, I can't have that anymore.
I drive by Monuts and go, oh, I really want a donut. But anyway.
Yeah.
Chronic disorder is difficult. You do. You make it through. And, you know, you were talking earlier, Mark, about how it kind of is a bully. And I'm at risk for all these other cancers and all these other diseases like heart disease and stroke and different things. And you just kind of put that in the back of your mind and say, well, something will get me eventually. I had a wonderful oncologist who, when he was telling me all about the different things that could happen to me later in life, he said, you could get hit by a bus. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. So, which was a good perspective to say, all these things could happen, or, you know, a meteorite could fall on me. I don't know. Something's going to happen eventually.
That's a hard pill to swallow, though, when the doctor's sitting there telling you these things, and you look at him like, you know what, that may be true, but right now we're talking about what? You know, like, hey, did you actually say that this happened? This is happening. This is a result of maybe this or this. And you know, they seem so optimistic. And I guess they try to get you in a different mindset. And it takes a while for it to set in, because it's like, you cannot be serious that this is happening to me. And you just said, I could get hit by a bus. Well, yeah, I can, but not really trying to. I'm trying to get rid of this issue that you just said I have. So how do we attack this? And then you have to really get, you know, that, and I guess you can attest to, you know, the days where you start feeling down and it's like, what did I do to deserve this? You know, I must have done something and I'm getting paid back for it. I don't remember or realize it. But then you have to realize that the hardest tests are given to the strongest soldiers, and it kind of takes a while to set in, but once it sets in, you then go to the mind frame of, I refuse to be defeated by this temporary setback. That's what I call it, you know.
Yeah, and somebody said something to me when I was in the throes of treatment is, you know, they were like, this is your thing that you have to deal with. Everybody has their thing that they have to overcome in life. And so if mine is an illness, then somebody else's maybe something else. You know, it could be a car accident.
Right.
Also, it is a very much of a wake-up call. The time I was thinking, oh, you have to rethink your life. And it was very much like the way people who've been in serious car accidents have that kind of like, this is going to change my life. Or if they have an awful relationship problem, they're left in the lurch or whatever. It's a wake-up call. And so there's only so many of those you can handle in one life at a time. But you do handle it.
Right.
And you do get through it. Also, at one point, they were like, oh, well, you know, you're going to get through this. And I just kind of came to me, well, what are my options? Either I fight this and I survive this, or I don't. It was like, I can
exactly.
sit down and cry,
like,
or I can
I don't have
on.
An option C there.
Yeah, there is no, I choose not to do this. So
right.
you have to do it, even whether you want to or not. So...
How did it impact, did it impact at all your, and I have never talked to you about this, but did it impact at all your kind of faith journey? Because I think we all go through a faith journey to some degree, no matter what the faith is.
It did to a certain extent. I was always a part of a church and always had a faith, but it really made me more solidify that and confront some of the things that people said. Early on, somebody said that it's God's will, and I really struggled with that for a long time because I was like, you know what? That's not the God that I believe in. you know, I'm thinking,
right.
There's no God there with, like, chess pieces saying, oh, you're going to get sick today, and you're not. And I'm like, yeah, you know, that's not my God. You know, I believe more in a benevolent God, and this is just something that terrible that happened to me and was kind of not a punishment for anything. Help me kind of rethink what I believed and kind of came to more of a, this is what I believe, and I don't believe in that rage thing. I kind of believe more in a much more benevolent God who's supporting me. And also I read a wonderful book called The Sparrow at that time and kind of believed more about and I read Job a bunch of times. I read the book of Job like 4 times when I was sick. Just to kind of help me through this, kind of like to find a good faith journey in that. And meditation.
Right.
I'm a firm believer in meditation and daily prayer.
Yeah, that's something that we all need to do on a regular basis is some sort of meditation and daily prayer because life throws you all kinds of curves, no matter what those curves are, whether it's cancer or whether it's just life in general.
Right.
Definitely throws you all kind of curves. Elizabeth, hold on a second there. Don't go anywhere. But I want to see if I'm along the same lines, because I did tell him to call in as well. Mr. Ham, are you still there?
Oh, yeah.
All right. How you doing, Mr. Ham?
All right. How you doing, Mr. Lee?
I'm doing good. Dean, this is the other person I told to call in real quickly. But his son actually went on, you know, we're talking about life-affirming events and everything. His son actually came here to the Hayti and competed in the amateur night here, and then he went to the Apollo, and he won.
Nice.
So he won the first round. He still got to go through 4 rounds, but he did win. So I did tell Mr. Ham to call because, we're trying to affirm some people to do a positive thing. So, Mr. Ham, do you want to tell about your experience when you went up to New York?
Oh, yes, here's my son. Here's Joshua Ham.
He's
going to tell
us.
All right, Joshua.
Okay.
Yes, it was a great experience going to New York. Like, it's different people, like, all around. It was just different. Like, and it was amazing to me going on the legendary stage of the Apollo. Like, not many people get that opportunity in their life, but it was amazing for me as a young man going on that legendary stage. So it was great for me going, having that experience there.
Cool. So you had a chance to go up there, and what were some of the things that you learned when you went up there that just shocked you about the city of New York?
Well, the people really, like, they're really different. Like, they're like, their time is like snap, snap, like speedy, speedy, like impatient, like on the road. Like, when we were driving, every single minute, like, my mom was just getting frustrated because they were beeping at her every second. She was like, I can't take this anymore. Like, it was funny. But they're different down there. But I kind of like it, like, the fast and, like, they call it the city that never sleeps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think they believe in sleep. Dean's been there a couple of times, and I don't think you slept when you went there, Dean.
Well, you got to remember, right here, I'm in Jersey, so I'm about an hour and 15 minutes away from Gotham, as they call it. You know, it never sleeps. There's always something to do. There's always something to see. And so, you know, being, if you're from out of town and, you know, once you get up this way and you see those lights never shut off, we're at home. I'm originally from Virginia. You know, after 10 o'clock, everything shuts down. But in New York, nothing shuts down. So it's always something to see and do and to actually experience. And it's pretty fun.
Definitely, yeah, it's a fun city. And you over there in Jersey always having a good time. So you probably slide into New York every once in a while. Hey, Joshua?
Yes, sir.
I think that Elizabeth, and because that's our other guest here, that's the survivor that wrote the book, and Dean, as well as myself, should hear you bout out of tutors, too, so they can hear what you did when you were up there. Why don't you give them a taste of what you could do?
Yeah.
So, a tip of what I did?
Uh-huh.
Oh, you want me to sing a little bit?
Yeah, sing a little bit over the phone. Let's go for it.
Yep.
Jehovah Jireh, you're my provider. Jehovah Nisi, Lord, you reign in victory. Jehovah Shalom, you're my Prince of Peace. And I worship you because of who you are.
Nice.
You see why the folks up there in New York liked them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that
exactly.
Was without saying.
Now, if how old are you?
I'm 15 years old.
Outstanding. Nice.
15 and already making a name for himself. Like I said, he's been up there, what has it been now, twice?
Yes, sir.
Been up there twice and got to go back for another round. But I believe that Captain does the event said that you registered like a 97 or a 98, and the only other person that's done that was Michael Jackson.
Yes, sir.
Wow. So, hey, can't complain about that. That's nice, man.
Yeah, he's definitely got a lot of challenge. We're definitely looking forward to hearing great things from him in the future. You got anything coming up in the near future, either here or elsewhere, other than the Apollo gig? I believe that's in September. Is that correct, either Joshua or Mr. Ham?
Yes, sir. September the 9th.
September the 9th. So only a little bit over a month away from now.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So we're definitely looking forward to hearing great things from you, but I just wanted to ask you to call in real quickly because I wanted to let the folks know what you had going on as well. And we know that, as you just said from your song, that the faith part of it is an important part to your message as well, because you're definitely very much involved in your church here in Durham.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, I'm going to get back to Elizabeth, but I definitely wanted the folks to hear you and get a taste of what you're all about. And we'll be keeping track of you and what you're doing so that they can see all of how you're doing in terms of your skills and everything. So you may get another call from the Voice of the People later on and see how you did in round three, as we'll call it, in this four or five round fight.
Okay, thank you for having me.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for calling in.
Okay, all right.
So, Elizabeth, you still there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a beautiful voice.
Yeah, he's got a very powerful voice. We do that at amateur night every Sunday, and there's some kids here that just blow my mind because it's both a kid and an adult category. And some of the kids are sitting there going like, that's coming out of your body?
You're 12 or 15.
Oh, that's actually going to ask in terms of skills, because you have, is it two daughters?
Yes, I do. I have two daughters. They are 21 and 19.
21 and 19, but at the time they were, that you were going through this, they were kids, and I was just wondering if any of them followed in your footsteps of being an author.
Well, not yet. My youngest, who's 19, writes very nicely, although she would probably write more academic and nonfiction things. She's actually trying to get some of her papers published. She's been writing in college about Mad Men, actually. She just wrote a really great story about feminism and Mad Men.
The TV show Mad Men?
Yeah, the TV show Mad Men.
I wanted to make sure that we were talking about the same thing. So
yeah.
How did she tie Mad Men into feminism?
She wrote a paper about Joan Harris, the character of Joan Harris, and lipstick feminism about in the 60s. So, yeah, so historic, you know, film criticism and women's history together. She's a smart little cookie, that kid. Yeah.
Sounds like she's very smart.
Yeah,
it sounds like she's trying to follow your footsteps and because what exactly, you may have told me when we were working together, but I know you're the creative one, but what does your husband do?
He works with computers.
Okay.
So he's an IT manager for a big company. So, yeah, so he was trained as an electrical engineer and then kind of took that into the computer side of manufacturing. Yeah, so he's a smart cookie too.
You're just surrounded by smart cookies, aren't you?
Yeah, they are. It's a smart little family. So,
okay,
and my eldest is in graduate school, so she's doing well too.
Graduating.
She's getting. She's going to the Bloomberg School of Public Health up in Baltimore, getting her graduate degree in public health.
Because even though you live here, you're not originally from here, are you?
No, I'm from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, which is in central Massachusetts. So I lived up there, went to school up there. My husband went to school up there, and then his parents moved down here to Winston-Salem, so we followed. My father-in-law had a heart attack in 1998, so we thought, well, we should move down and be close to them, because, you know, we don't know how long he's going to live, and he's going fine. He's fine. He's still going strong.
Still going strong, huh?
Yeah, so we jumped the gun on that one, but it's been great, and it's been nice to be close to my in-laws and my husband's brothers and sisters, too.
Well, it sounds like they did the opposite of you. They instead of going from south to north, they went north to south.
Yes, they were living in upstate New York at the time, yeah. So, yeah, but they love it here. It really becomes southern. So
how much of the southern habits have they developed? Are they the ones running to get sweet tea?
Oh my gosh, yes, my father-in-law loves sweet tea, and he is a connoisseur of barbecue. And we, when I first started visiting them, they had pig pickings in their backyard. So that was fun, and they love to go to the Outer Banks, the Blue Ridge Mountains. I mean, they've really kind of embraced the South. And then I've loved living in Durham all these, the last 12, 15 years. We've kind of tried to embrace it as much as we can, going to the blues festivals and learning what we can about the area.
Yes, you were also very much involved with the literary festival, and Dean knows about that because I talked to him about it a couple of times, and you were definitely involved in that, both as a presenter as well as sharing excerpts of your book along with several other local authors.
Yeah, no, it was a great book festival, and there's a lot of book festivals in North Carolina. I can't get over how many book festivals there are. And there's a lot of authors in North Carolina. There's actually more, they call it the writingest state. There's a lot of authors here, so it's a nice community of authors in the area.
You find that a lot of them are actually communicating a lot with each other? Because I know some communities, I know like in New York and other places, they kind of like stay in their own worlds. But it seems to me like down here, we've developed almost like a writing culture, almost like I hate to even kind of make this parallel, but almost like a cross-generational and cross-racial kind of version of almost what was going on with the black writers in the Harlem Renaissance, where there's authors of different types that are always connecting and talking to each other.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's very much true. There's a Durham Writers Network that gets together like twice a month, and it's kind of like free form. You just kind of show up, and there's
several large communities in Raleigh of like 500 writers, and they are very helpful to each other and little
wow.
seminars, writers groups, and there's what's nice is that there's some very, very experienced and very successful writers in the area that kind of reach out and help some of the newer writers and kind of give them advice and different things like that. And there's also a lot of small presses in the area. There's quite a few small presses, and one of the biggest poetry small presses is in Greensboro. So,
which one is that?
Press 53. They do a lot with poetry.
Okay.
They're great. I really like them.
I did not know that, but I was aware of Carolina Wren, which is also here in the area, and they do a lot of stuff and have been doing stuff for years as a
mm-hmm.
small press for independent, fiction kind of writers and writers.
Right, and they don't produce a lot of books per year, Carolina Wren, but the ones that they do are very good. They really are, very careful about what they do. I really respect, as opposed to just throwing out a gazillion books and seeing what sticks. So, I really like
them. Yeah, I think that's what happens with some of the other companies, some of the bigger companies.
Yeah.
They sit there and...
It's another reason to work with a small press. Yeah, it's another reason to work with a small press is that they really do put a lot of effort, and, you want to work with a company that maybe only puts out one or two books a month, or only one a month. So they can really put a lot of energy into getting it out and getting people knowing about it and helping you get the word out, which is hard in this day and age. It's like the music industry. It's hard to kind of get your album out there or your book or your movie or whatever you've created.
Yes. It's not like it used to be. It is more difficult, but it seems but the good thing is it seems like the internet in terms of and social media has opened it up in terms of making it easier to get the word out when you do publish something, that you're able to get it out to a larger crowd versus having to depend on the big publishing houses, because you can kind of on your own.
Yes. You can do a lot on your own, and there's different ways of doing things. And it changes every year. Right now, something that is very helpful is to give things away, to do a giveaway. There's a wonderful website called Goodreads that people are talking about books. It's fun. And you can put up a giveaway, and people say, I'd be interested in reading that book, and they sign up. And it's a good way to get your word out there as well. Facebook is always helpful, and Twitter, but, that gets a little noisy as well, because there's a lot of people on Twitter, and there's a lot of people on Facebook. So there's ways to get out there. But I still think the best way to talk to readers is face-to-face. I loved going on a book tour and just sitting down and talking to groups of people about my books and what they're interested in. I read a lot, so I talk a lot about books that they're reading.
Yeah, you actually mentioned on your page about an author that you have a great deal of respect for, and you talked about the fact that they did their book signing a little bit differently than a lot of other ones, because I've been to if you want to tell people about that.
Yeah, her name is Mary Doria Russell, one of my favorite authors of all time, because she is, her last two books have been about the OK Corral. They were about Doc Holliday and that whole stuff. And so when she came and talked, she talked in at Quail Ridge in Raleigh. And she didn't do a reading. She didn't be like, poor little me kind of thing. Because sometimes people are very self-deprecating. She told us about the history and how her book gets it right and all these other books didn't get it right, and about the personalities behind it, and was very like, this is who I am. This is what I wrote. Buy my book or don't, kind of thing. And I really respected that.
Mm.
And she writes beautifully. She wrote that book, The Sparrow. She wrote a book about called Dreamers of the Day, that was from the point of view of one young woman whose entire family was killed by the Spanish flu and went over to the Middle East and met Lawrence of Arabia and learned about the whole partitioning of the Middle East after World War I. And I learned more about that time period and that whole process than I did in any history class I ever took. And it was a little short book. It was like 200 pages. And it was very entertaining. So I really respected that. And it's nice to meet the authors that you admire. And you can. They come on tour. It's the nice thing about living in North Carolina.
Yeah, you can meet them at the different you can meet them at the different bookstores and things like that. Now, just to get to the negative side of publishing, what are some of the things that you found out when you got involved in publishing and writing and literature that you wish you didn't know? Things that kind of like you discovered about the literature industry that are not all that great.
Well, the main thing that I learned was that as much as the publishing industry says, oh, we want something that's unique and different, that's not true. They pretty much want the same book characters. It's like, oh, yeah, no, that's a little too strange. They really, you know, and also the other thing is that women are still not taken as seriously as men are, and women of color are really not taken as seriously as men are. I've noticed that with some friends of mine. People say, oh, it's women's fiction. It's a chick book. They want to put, you know, even no matter how serious your book is, they want to put, you know, pretty a girl with long blonde hair on the cover.
That's not going to work.
Yeah, that's not going to work. Exactly. But,
you start reading the material, you're like, wait a minute.
Exactly. And they, you know, and people, when I first started talking to people about, oh, I'm writing this book about a person who has cancer, they're like, oh, well, nobody's going to want to read that. And that's not true. I've gotten an incredibly good response. I have up on my wall in my writing room, I have emails that I've received from people all over the world now that have contacted me saying, thank you for writing this book. I was looking for a book like this. It was a happy book about cancer. Because people weren't writing them. There aren't that many. And people want a romance. I don't write romance. I'm just really bad at writing romance, and so my books don't have, they don't have love stories in them. There's a lot of friendships in my books, and occasionally people get killed. But in some of my other books, people get killed. But that's what I write. But
are you guessing people off in your book?
She also
What?
I said
taking them out.
She's taking them out.
They don't last. Yeah.
Nope.
They don't last to the end. They don't get to see the end.
Nope. Not everybody survives. And I also write murder mysteries, so those are fun.
Wow.
Finding different interesting ways
to kill
people.
I mean, just dusting them off at the end like you're not going to make it.
I do worry about the TSA looking at my Google history, but my research, how to think about with somebody in it, things like that. It's all part of the writing life. Wow. I love that part of the writing life. You are the person who creates the world, and you can have whatever you want happen in that world.
But if the FBI looks at it, they might take it a different way.
They'd be like, what are you researching?
She's dusting people off in the book. We have to.
Yeah. Well, for instance, for my first book, I had to research at what point does a corpse, the head pop off when you sink a corpse in a lake? That was fun. It's hard to find that research, that information. I actually had to call an anatomist at UNC to figure that out.
And he's probably sitting there going, like, why does she want to know this?
Yeah, that's an interesting question you ask. Like, ma'am, please tell us why you want to know this information.
Yes, I always have to preface it. I'm writing a mystery, and I need to know if this is going to work. And they're usually, people are remarkably forthcoming with information. I talked to several oncologists about when I was writing How to Climb the Eiffel Tower to make sure that I was getting everything correct. And make sure that the treatments were correct and the time frame was correct and all that kind of information. And I spent a lot of time sitting in waiting rooms. I live here in Durham and Duke University Hospital was right here. And so I would just go down, sit in the waiting room, talk to people. People were very nice. They didn't know about their
And they just tell you everything, right?
People do. I'm a student of psychology and you learn a lot about social psychology and how people don't talk. But
that all goes out the window when you're in an oncology ward. People will tell you their entire life history in 5 minutes. Because they will. Yeah, they really will. There's like they're under strain, and they will talk. So.
They tell you their whole life story right there, and then Elizabeth will turn it into a book, or she'll. Dean, I'm worried now. I think that she might make you into a character, and then you're gonna get off. I'm really worried now.
They dust it off at the end, right, or somewhere in the middle. Like we gotta take this dude out, man.
Yeah,
somewhere in the middle.
Never know.
I mean, you've got a last name like Geronimo. You know you're supposed to go out.
Yeah, you know, and then the interesting part is how people function after I'm gone, and it'll get better and more acceptable after I'm done.
So now I just come up with the perfect solution. Because you know we've been teasing, and she didn't call today because she told me she was going to actually, she might not make it in to call, but we'll have to have Elizabeth call in on another time. But Ty did not make it in. And you know, we're always saying that she's in the Slammer, that little publication and everything.
Yeah.
So I've got an idea now. Are you ready, Dean? Because you know I've got a little bit of
an idea.
I think we need to get Elizabeth to write the scenario as to how she got into the Slammer.
Yeah,
sure
that might be real interesting. How will we title that?
I don't know. But either you or me can send her some information on Ty, and then she can write a whole little scenario about what got Ty into the Slammer.
Yeah.
I love to do stuff like that.
When she's gone, we get devious up in here, man. So, you know, we better be careful because we'll have that first chapter printed and posted on the Voice of the People Facebook page. So if you're listening to us tonight, remember, Voice of the People is every Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/ Ty Jones, The Voice. If we can get that chapter up, we'll have it on there for your viewing pleasure. And we'll thank Elizabeth for her words and her
so your
her mastery of the language.
So your assignment now is to get Elizabeth's email so that you can send her information about Ty, and we're gonna write her Slammer episode.
The Slammer episode, the Voice of the People Slammer edition. That's what we're doing right now.
Poor Ty, she doesn't show up.
She doesn't show up.
No, she doesn't say well. Doesn't show up, we go in. She'll listen to it later and say, you know what? They did it again. We sure did. This is what we do. Now, if anyone is listening and wants to call in and join in the conversation, you can call us at 914-338-0659. Join the conversation, speak with Elizabeth Hine, author of, what's the name of the book again?
How to Climb the Eiffel Tower.
How to Climb the Eiffel Tower. I just wanted you to say it. So.
Available wherever books are sold.
Nice.
Now, you know, I'm aware of some of them, but not all of them, and we've been teasing, but I am serious. You do need to write that episode about the Slammer episode for Ty, but tell us a little bit about some of the mysteries that you've written and a little bit of their history, because I'm not that familiar with them. I did read the book, but How to Climb the Eiffel Tower, but the mysteries I haven't got around to reading, so give us one or two of those.
The mysteries have not been published yet, that's why you have to write them. But they're a series, it's going to be a series, of two women who are friends from childhood, Midge and Snake, and they like to travel. They're going to go to the Galapagos, and somebody's going to die. And then they're going to go to Barcelona, and somebody's going to die. And then they're going to go to Hawaii, and somebody's going to die. Yeah, so you see how this goes.
So are they killing folks? Because everybody dies. What's going on with that?
No, they don't.
I mean, they're thinking... So what you're saying is this. They're actually traveling and dusting folks off at the same time. Is that what you just said?
No, they are like, innocent. Kind of like, did you ever watch that, you know, like Hercule Poirot, he goes on safari or something and somebody ends up dead. Or, you know, this, remember that show, what was that called? Murder, She Wrote. Somebody always ended up dead. So it's that kind of idea where they're not policemen, but they're kind of amateur sleuths. And their full name is Snigda, is a microbiologist. And the other one is a state representative. And so they are, you know, pretty smart gals. And they like to travel. So, and I like to travel. So I'm taking some of my notes that I've taken on my trips and making them into books.
Wait a minute. You just said one of them was a politician. We all know that politicians go dusting off people all the time.
She's a good politician.
Exactly.
She's a state rep. She's a good person. She's kind of feisty. So those are my mystery books. I'm going to try to get them so that they can all kind of come out at once. And then my other book, my first book is called Overlook, and that is a, you know, your classic cheating husband kind of book. You know, guess is at the end. And then there's a sequel of that called Escape Plan, which is probably going to come out next year. And that's it. Kind of a follow-up to the first one. It's very much Desperate Housewives meets North Carolina in the 1970s.
All right. So, but I'm still trying to get back to the murder mystery. So what was the name of those two characters again?
Midge and Snig.
Midge and Snig, right?
Yeah. Snig is short for Snigda.
All right, but Midge and Snig. D,
yep.
If you get an invitation to any place from Midge and Snig, don't go.
Don't go. End up dead.
There's always somebody dead.
If you get an invitation from Midge and Snig, don't go.
Don't go. Yep.
Right. I'm staying in.
As soon as you get that envelope, you're
dusting people off, buddy.
Yeah, soon as you get that envelope that's addressed Midge and Snig, I would say I'm not going.
It's over. They go very fun places, but things do not turn out well. So.
See,
I love to travel, so it's fun to.
That's interesting.
Now, what are some of the fun places that you have actually traveled to that you enjoyed going to?
Oh, well, the Galapagos Islands were fabulous. I really did enjoy those. Those are way out in the Pacific, and that's where you have the giant tortoises, frigate birds, and, you know, penguins. It's really great. And then I liked Costa Rica. That was great. I enjoyed going to the rainforest there, and there's volcanoes there. And, we went to Tikal in Guatemala. That was really fun, which is, you know, old Mayan ruins. I love to travel. We've gone to Barcelona. I lived in Spain when I was little. France a bunch of times. So we like to travel a lot. One of my goals is to go to see Angkor Wat, which is in Cambodia. I really want to go to these days.
But, you know, I got a letter from that turtle, and that turtle said that you were not supposed to be riding his back. It was sitting there. It sent me a letter, and it said, how come she got on my back and tried to ride me?
You know, it's funny you say that, because when we were in Galapagos, there was a little kid who got on one of the backs of the turtles and the tortoises. And then the guys were like, no, do not touch the tortoises. But because they are giant. They came up to, like, my shoulder. They were amazingly huge tortoises. And they have birds there. They have blue feet. They're called blue-footed boobies. They're really fun birds.
The birds have blue feet?
They have bright blue feet. And they make this funny little dance. They're really very interesting birds, and they only live there. And they dive from hundreds of feet in the air, and they kind of, like, shoot down into the water to catch the fish. And it's like, how do they knock themselves out? It was fascinating to see all the wildlife and all the finches, and that's where Darwin was. Also, they're not, the animals in the Galapagos are not afraid of people, so the sea lions will come right up to you when you're scuba diving or snorkeling, and they'll come right up to you and want to play, because they don't understand that you're a predator. They think you just, like, want to play.
So you remember that, Dean, when you go up there, two things. When you go up there and you see the sea lion, he just wants to play. He's not trying to eat you.
He's not trying to eat you. He just wants
to play. You know
what? And the other thing I want you to remember, because this is the one that's really scaring me, but, you know, she is a writer, so I'm taking her word for it, but there is some sort of bird there that's got blue feet that likes to dance.
He does.
The bird. The dancing bird with blue feet, right?
Yep. It's called a blue-footed booby. They are very cute.
A blue-footed booby?
Yep.
You know what? That's something you stay away from. That's one of those.
Yep. They have some very interesting t-shirts that you can get at the airport.
I believe it.
Yep. They have blue-footed boobies and red-footed boobies. Red-footed ones aren't as cute, but blue ones are really cute.
So they got
red is not as cute as blue.
Bird.
They like to dance.
They do. They love to dance.
They like to dance.
They do. They are very fun. Very fun. Yeah.
As long as they gonna end up biting some folks.
As long as they don't bite nobody, as long as they don't introduce him to their friend, the sea lion that just wants to play.
Yeah, just wants to play.
But he weighs about 500 pounds, probably.
Well, and they do. They're
they're going to gain your trust and eat you up.
You can go snorkeling out there and you're looking at fish and turtles and things under the water. And then suddenly this big sea lion will come up to you right in front of your face and like blow bubbles in your face. And they want you to blow bubbles back. And then they spin around and look at you, and they think you're like an amusing thing. It's a little frightening, but it was fun. It was quite fun.
Animals have some of the most interesting lives, and Elizabeth is right there in the middle, capturing it all while she's trying to think of things to write about them.
Right, exactly. That's
right.
Well, I think we could get ready to wrap it up, but I'm sure that we need to get some great advice from you. How do we usually wrap this thing up, Dean? We usually ask the guests if they have some words of wisdom. Isn't that what Ty usually says?
Words of wisdom, final thoughts. So, we gonna go ahead and let our guests start off and, we'll go from there.
Well, I guess final thoughts is, there's difficulties in life like cancer, but you can get through it with hope and with friendship.
Nice.
Very nice.
Nice. Mark, your final thought?
Well, one of my final thoughts is that I need to do more traveling because I've been wanting to travel all my life. There are certain countries that I want to go to. I've only been to Turkey when I was a little kid. My dad was stationed in the airport, so I got to go to Turkey as a little kid. And I have, this vision. My parents think that I've lost my mind and that it really didn't happen. But I used to have this dream that because we live somewhere near a coast, that I saw, some of the wildlife. But I never physically saw them, or if I did, I was one. So I probably, that might be just like one of them memories that's in the back of your brain that might be partially based on fact, partially based on imagination. So I do remember that, but that's the only time that I stepped outside of the USA. So one of the things as I hit the 50s that I want to do is more world travel. And now that Elizabeth has told me that there are blue-feeted birds out there that love to dance, and I'm sure that there's some other weird animals in places like Belize and Jamaica and Australia and some of the other countries that I want to go to, Kenya. I think I need to go there so that I can analyze some of these crazy animals that I've never seen before that have weird features like blue-feeted. They're not web feet, are they?
Blue?
Yeah, they are web.
She said some are red, too.
And she said they're web, too. They're blue-feeted webbed feet that love to dance. And I'm sitting here at the Hayti right now visualizing this bird dancing, and I'm seeing a combination of Big Bird and Red Fox.
Hey, now I've been to Belize, but I haven't seen that those special characters roaming around. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention.
Well, they say, they say, and I'm not saying this in a sexist way, but they say that there are also some very nice young ladies in Belize. So you might have been distracted.
Mm-hmm. But you said paying attention to other things, and the animals were not a part of that equation, huh?
That's what I'm thinking.
Well, you know what? Hey, man, we're going to figure it out as we travel along. We just got to make sure that when we travel, unlike the stories that Elizabeth is putting out, we all come back alive, and so nobody's questioning us. We don't have time to be questioned by the authorities, via, you know, wondering what's going on with us. But you know what? We thank you. And
I told
and, you,
you
know,
the key to that. Don't invite those two guests. I told you.
Don't invite the two. Oh, I'm not, man. I'm really not. I'm gonna kind of look at some people, and if I think I hear those two names, you know, I'm gonna start running in the opposite direction just to be on the safe side. But okay. You know, we she said, okay, we still gonna get you. Like, run, but you can't hide. It's like one of them horror movies. I'll be screaming, like, shut up, just take it. It's your
and
turn.
You know
your number has come
you know
up.
You know where the first ones to go.
I know, right?
If I don't, she's the first one to go.
Listen. She's just laughing. Listen, she's just a little giggle. The little giggle. See, we gotta be careful, man. I might not go outside tomorrow. No, but we definitely thank you for, you know, riding with us this evening on the Voice of the People. We wish you a lot of success. We're going to be looking for the rest of those books to come out. The one now, How to Climb the Eiffel Tower, you can actually find it on Amazon.com. So if you're listening, go check that book out and support Elizabeth Hine. My final thought here for the night, when we're talking about cancer and different illnesses and stuff like that, it's time to not be scared of doctors. It's time to make sure that you get your checkups. You do, you know, you take your medications if you have to take them, and stay up on your health, because we only come this way but once. And once that is over, we don't get to come back. We can't push a reset button or anything like that. The hardest tests are given to the strongest soldiers. So keep persevering. Make sure that you stay on top of everything. And with that, Dean Geronimo is out. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Voice of the People. Every Wednesday night, 8 p.m., blogtalkradio.com/Ty Jones The Voice. Or you can call in and join the conversation at 914-338-0659. Ladies and gentlemen, we appreciate you. Have a good evening.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate you.
Thanks so much.
Right.
Great.
Good.
Thank you.
Peace.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Peace and blessings. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Voice of the People. Tune in every week, Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. on blogtalkradio.com/Ty Jones The Voice, or you can call in and join the conversation at 914-338-0659. Also, we can be found on Facebook, facebook.com/Ty Jones The Voice. I am Dean Geronimo. Good evening, good night, and God bless.